Why did it count backwards? I know that we're now recording.
What? Hello, Captain.
What
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
What are we going to talk about?
I don't know. So, leadership, life, and everything else.
Yeah.
G'day, leaders. In this podcast, we had the absolute privilege of speaking with Julia Malinak. She is an international opera superstar, a polymath. She's very much like our Captain Michelle, who can do anything. And we had an absolute ball learning about her singing career and all of the other things that she's done and is continuing to do. Enjoy.
And we're live.
No, we're recording.
In Hello. The studio with a guest.
Yes.
How exciting.
The lovely.
All the way from UK.
Yeah, lovely.
I'm excited.
Amazing Julia.
So, Michelle, do you want to give us a little bit of a background about Julia?
Because
I'm excited because we've got another polymath in the room.
Yeah.
Julia, have you heard the term polymath?
Yes, I know what a polymath is.
So Michelle,
yes, definitely.
Michelle can do anything. Like she can weld, she can paint, she can fly planes. She's a teacher, she's a speaker. There's nothing she can't do. And I've heard you're quite similar.
Yes.
No, you're like a sister from another mother.
For sure. Yeah, we have very parallel lives, don't we?
We do.
Let's start with the big one, international renowned opera singer.
That's not me. That's Julia.
I've heard you sing. It's definitely not you. I'm sorry, Michelle.
I was just saying to Michelle before we started this that people sometimes say to me, what do you do? And I sort of, I don't really know because I do so many
That's
things.
It. You did.
Yes.
So we've got, what else have we got in there? We've got property development.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I've done a lot of things. Yes, I've started lots of businesses. My gut... I identify as an opera singer because that's what I've done most of my life.
Yeah.
But I have had, I had the largest gay dining club in the UK.
The largest gay dining club
at
in the
one
UK?
Point,
well,
yes.
That's going to be a conversation we're going to be having. That
yeah,
interesting.
That was before the internet, so it's showing how old I am.
Yeah, yeah. So just come a little bit closer.
A little bit closer,
that's
okay. Yeah, there you go.
That's nice.
And, several businesses, lots of property. And now I am a magician.
a magician. Okay. My mind is wrapping itself around the spelling of that word. So I'm assuming it's got something to do with...
Vaginology.
Vaginology.
My passion. I don't call it a job because you can't call it a job. My passion, my hobby is supporting women to have babies at home.
Oh, how
so
cool.
Yes, I trained as a midwife rather late in life for a passion, and it is a labour of love, as they say.
A labour of love.
Yeah.
I like what you're doing there with all these
labor,
words.
Yes.
Not only a polymath, you've got the gift of,
designing
your own language almost. So, magician, is that actually a word or is that a term?
No, that's me.
That's you.
Yes.
I love that. That's brilliant.
Lady Julia the magician.
Lady Julia the magician.
I pull magic things out of vaginas.
Okay.
Can I say vagina on the podcast?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
You
can beep it. That's not explicit language.
No, I know, but you don't know whether people
like the word.
Mm. Yes.
Well, it's a word. And
it is.
Yeah.
It's an anatomical, word.
So where do we start with Julia? If like she's like you, a polymath, we could talk for hours. Can we start with the opera?
Yes.
Because that was
sure.
early on, wasn't it?
That was what's early on.
Early on in your career?
Well, it was from as...
The age
I was
of
singing.
Two,
yes, I was singing before I could talk. Literally,
oh, wow.
I was standing on coffee tables, being that irritating child who always wanted to perform and always the loudest in the school choir. And in my heart, I wanted to do medicine, which is probably why I came into the midwifery later. But and I was going to do medicine, but loved performing.
Yeah,
I loved music theatre, but my parents didn't think that was sort of a proper job. But when I discovered my operatic voice, they supported me, and I switched when I was about 17 and went down the opera path.
Oh, fantastic.
But it was always very normal for me when I meet people and I say I'm an opera singer, they think it's very glamorous and wow, and to me it was just normal. Everybody I knew were opera singers, and went and did it straight from school, and just worked in it, and it was it was pretty amazing.
So you stepped onto the stage from school, straight into opera?
Yes. I went straight to a music conservatoire, trained there, and went straight from there. Most people leave there and will do one season in the Glyndebourne chorus. I don't know if you've heard of Glyndebourne. No. It's a beautiful country house opera.
Yeah.
And it has choristers who go on to become soloists. Mm-hmm. And straight from there, I went on and sang my first Don Giovanni. And then I specialised in Puccini and mainly Madame Butterfly. Madame Butterfly, bless her, played my mortgage for a very long time, yes.
Oh, wow. Where did that take you around the world? I presume you travelled with it?
Yes, all over the place. So I was working internationally. Eventually, I was trying to work more at home because I had children.
Yes.
But I did a season in New Zealand, in Israel, Italy. I mean, you name it, I've probably been there.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. It's not as glamorous as it sounds, living out of a suitcase and you know, being away, but you make some amazing friends.
Yeah.
And then you keep seeing those friends each time you turn up for a job, you see who the cast is.
Yeah.
And the greatest joy, making amazing music.
We spoke about this before we started recording, how you said you got more enjoyment out of the
journey,
creation than the actual performing. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. I mean, I think most musicians, you're not doing it for the applause. People think it's this glamorous, you know, the applause, and then you come out and sign autographs. It's nothing to do with that. It's the absolute love of studying that score. Mm. The great butterflies who came before me, the great butterflies who are still out there doing it after me. Mm. We've all studied that score and made of it our interpretation and our love of that music. And what the public get to see is their own interpretation of our interpretation, and it's such a joy. It's a spiritual journey and is an utter privilege. And yes, it's the rehearsals, the development of that character. I think I was saying to you before, the emotional journey you go on is, I mean, in opera, I think opera is the ultimate form for that expression of emotion, and to feel that depth of emotion on stage. Life is a pretty poor imitation afterwards.
Wow.
Mm. So I can see why a lot of marriages don't make it past... Yes, because you're away from home, you're having these passionate moments on stage.
Yeah.
And then you come home to a partner who's been there looking after the kids, is fed up, and it's like, it's the mundanity that you you just don't have on stage. So... life and art are not really imitating each other. You wish they did a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful time, and was my norm. It was nothing glamorous or interesting. I mean, I realized later on, when I did stop singing, how I'd lost something that was extraordinary. Mm. It was, to me, I loved singing and loved singing to the end, but I didn't love the lifestyle.
Was it an ego death that you had at the end? So Michelle describes when she obviously gave up.
Yeah, oddly, yes, because there was no ego involved in singing. It was my normal. There was no significance. I didn't feel that I was a superstar or special. However, when you lose it, you suddenly think, "Who am I?"
Yes. Because,
and you realise that people actually wanted to be friends with you because, oh, you're the opera singer. People would come up to me in the school playground and go, oh, you're the opera singer. We'd really love to have you for dinner. And I used to hate that. I used to actually abhor the significance that came with being a singer. But when I lost it, yes. And so when people say to me now, what do you do? Even though I midwife more than I sing, I tend to say, well, I'm an opera singer because it's what I've done most of my life. And I still sing every day with my dogs in my kitchen.
Well, we've got quite an echoey studio that we're in today, so maybe we can get you to hit a note later and see
Put the links to some of your performances in the show notes.
What
as well
idea.
That would probably be
a
better
very powerful voice.
I actually once did a radio show. They got me on and they had a crystal glass, and my challenge was to sing a high note and smash the glass.
How did you go?
Well, unfortunately, I turned up and it wasn't a crystal glass. Oh, it was sort of like
an IKEA
drinking glass. Yeah. And so they literally did it and then they smashed it on the wall and we pretended. So,
oh, wow.
Yes, nice. That was LBC London. I'm dobbing you in.
So is that like, I always thought that was a get smart like myth that an opera singer could actually, can you break glass?
I think if it's a high quality crystal glass,
the right resonating
you hit
note.
What you do is you flick the glass, yes. You get the note,
yeah.
Right. And then you sing that at high intensity. And apparently, I haven't done it, yeah. But I do believe it works.
So match the energy.
Might be able to find some crystal in the kitchen.
Do we want to?
I need to be careful about what we've got around us.
We're in the kitchen.
Wow, what a start to your journey. Like when we were talking, Michelle and I, when we first met, and how she gave up flying and yes. I gave up sport, and both of us experienced that massive ego death because you just don't know who you are.
Julia explained it really well. Whilst you're in it, you're not going around thinking that you're...
But ego is just your identity.
Correct.
It's when it's gone.
And it's another thing we went through really at a similar time together, isn't it?
We did too, and it was just that identity loss, not knowing what we were because we'd been it was a label that we could attach to.
Yes.
And it was easy. And also it was one that was revered, like you said.
A conversation starter.
That's right. Yes. Olympian.
But it's more that when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you wake up and you think, all right, I'm a pilot, I'm an opera singer, I'm a sportsman or whatever it is.
I still wake up in the mornings going, is it still there?
I dream about
me singing.
No, yes, all the time.
Thank you. You're so kind.
No, I dream about playing sport, that I'm still in the team, that I get the call up and the dream just won't go away.
And I'm sure if you get an injury, you're thinking, oh no, because I mean, for me, if I get a cold, I still panic.
Wow.
I still think, because if we got a cold, we didn't get paid.
Yes. Mm.
You didn't get paid for rehearsal periods.
Of course.
So you'd fly off somewhere on your own dollar or pounds in my case. And you would turn up, you would rehearse for 6 weeks. If you had a cold on that first night, you don't get paid.
Wow.
It happens. So we were very precious about anything respiratory. And now I can get a cold and it's like, ha-ha! Although then I can't infect new mummies. So there you go.
So, yes. What's your favourite memory? If you were to look through your career as an opera singer, what would be your favourite memory? What comes straight to the front of your mind when I ask you that question?
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, people always used to say to me, what's your favourite role? And it was always whatever I was doing at the time.
Yeah.
Because I would absolutely fall in love with my heroine. And the roles I did, they always were heroines. They were the most beautiful, gorgeous women. And I would identify so strongly with them. And I very much method acted.
Method acting,
so I would come, when I was doing Butterfly, I would do little, tiny little geisha steps and try and sort of look through my Diana eyelids and sort of Lady Diana, Princess Diana, that sort of demure. I would practice it in every cell of my body, and it was a cellular thing. So I think the love affairs I had with those characters and that passion I felt, I think if I look back, that's my memory. And I think also, the memory of getting my first, I mean, I was doing nice roles quite early on, but when I got my first big break at English National Opera and they said, we'd like you to come and sing Madame Butterfly. And that was quite early on in my career. And that was, I remember exactly where I was sitting and how incredible that felt and how, and again, not because of the significance, but of the opportunity to sing in that amazing, in the Coliseum in London, singing that role was fabulous. And then it went on to doing Butterfly in lots of other places. So maybe Fantastic. That was a great moment.
I love when I hear people who have reached the pinnacle in their chosen field, when they describe how they embody, like you were doing the little steps.
Yes.
And it's Michelle and I have spoken a lot about alter egos recently. You read a fantastic book recently just about how many very successful athletes, many successful singers, many successful people develop this alter ego so that they could fully embody what it was that they were doing.
I think, well, it's like athletes who rehearse the whole thing in their heads. And yes, I mean, like you do, you feel and be that person in your head. And then when you go out there, I mean, people would say, well, do you get nervous? And it's like, no, it's not me there.
It's Cho-Cho-San.
It's Madame Butterfly up there singing. So I was, machine.
That's the coffee machine.
Yeah.
sorry, we've already had a couple. We don't need you for the moment. Thank you very much.
But actually, another great moment was, and this is not artistically sort of revered, but it was wonderful, was when I sang at Glastonbury.
Oh, wow. Tell us
and
about
we
that.
Had, it was the first time Glastonbury had, you know what Glastonbury
yes,
is,
yes.
Yeah. It was the first time Glastonbury had ever had an opera company.
Oh, really?
And they invited us to come and do Valkyrie. And we had 100,000 people singing along. Dun, 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 dun,
oh,
dun.
Wow.
And, you know, throwing things at the stage. And it was, I felt like a rock star.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I had Paul McCartney in the dressing room
oh,
next door.
Wow.
James Brown, when we finished, he was like, you know, are you finished, ladies? I can't do his deep growl of a voice. And that was extraordinary, coming out on the stage. And there's a Valkyrie. It was one time I broke character, because the Valkyries are supposed to be these formidable Amazonian women.
Yeah.
And we all just came on with big smiles. We were so excited. It was a very exciting moment. Not artistically necessarily, but it was my moment of being a rock star.
That's extraordinary.
I remember when I first knew of you, met you. I hadn't met you in person, but
you hated me.
I did, and I really wanted to dislike you. And
are we going to go into that story?
No,
all right. So for our listeners,
I googled everything about you, as you knew that I did, and I stalked you basically on social media.
It's okay,
and
I stalked you back. It's fine. It's fine.
I know. And yes. And your performances were on YouTube, and I really wanted to dislike you, and it's like.
But you've got to let people know why. You can't just say that, oh, I didn't want to like you.
Julia was dating my boyfriend.
Well, I think
when
Michelle
I was
dating my boyfriend, we might find, yeah.
And you ended up being best friends.
Yeah,
okay, they can read it in the book when
yeah,
the book comes
yeah,
out.
Yeah, it was the
or watch
the cat,
movie when
the
you write that
we
script.
We were both dating at the same time.
It was the other woman movie times a million.
Yes,
but,
that's right.
But with somebody a lot less unattractive.
It wasn't at all.
But you ended up being best friends.
But we ended up, yes.
That's right.
Adoring each
yes,
other, because
yes.
We finally had a lot more than that in common.
Apart from being
a
beautiful
scoundrel.
And amazing. Yes.
And fabulous. And fabulous every day.
But
yes.
Yeah, the music, like you've said, you know, it's so passionate, and sound and music do reach the soul. And, you know, even Valkyrie, that it changes a heartbeat almost, and the fact that 100,000 people singing along with you, and it gives, I've got goosebumps now thinking about it.
It
but
does.
I remember I was watching you, and even my parents, they were watching with
they
me.
They wanted to hate
they,
me too.
They did. They loved the drama of it. But they, you know, and my dad was saying, oh, she's quite good, isn't she?
Dad, you meant to not like her.
But then you've taught their dog to sing.
I have taught. Yeah, I teach a lot of dogs to sing. So yes, it's, but that's another thing I love.
I might run next door and grab a dog and sing. Put on the podcast.
Singing.
Rocky,
yeah.
Rocky, yeah.
But it does lift you, and that's the thing is if you're having a bad day, it can change your state in a heartbeat. Mm. You start singing, it will transport you. And I love sound healing now,
yes.
You know, sort of singing bowls and gongs, and they do change you. And
yeah.
Buddhist chanting, and going back to midwifery, it's something that, I was told that I had the noisiest birth they'd ever had in the hospital. That's my claim to fame. Another operatic moment, because I sang through my births.
Wow.
And it was analgesia. It relieved the pain for me. It transported me. We were talking about early yesterday.
And this
shutting.
Is your births where you gave birth.
This is
not
my
birth
when I gave
people.
Birth. Yeah. And because you shut off the neocortex at that moment and you become at one with the sounds.
Mm.
And it was something I felt really passionate about. And then I started sharing that with people. And then I was supporting other people through birth. And then the whole midwifery journey sort of started partly as well through the journey with Michelle, because I was thinking, well, maybe that's an entree into Australia, because they didn't need opera singers, but they did need midwives.
Okay.
And you had been offered a role with Sydney Opera House.
So I'd auditioned at Sydney Opera House, and yes, they were sort of get yourself a visa, get yourself over here, and we can actually, you know, give you a lot of work here, which was obviously super exciting. But anyway, that's a whole other podcast. That's going down another
yeah.
rabbit
yeah,
hole.
Australia is the worst that we didn't make that happen.
Yes, for sure. That was another reason. But actually, all worked out as everything does.
It
for the
does.
Best, and
everything
it actually
works, yeah.
put me on another trajectory. But I did in the end. I did the midwifery. it was sort of almost to get over a broken heart. I just sort of thought I did it as a part-time course.
Yeah.
This wasn't the degree. And then before I knew it, I was applying and doing the degree, which I thought, I'll do it for fun. I'll do a BSc at the age of 107. And and it had to be the top university doing it. So it was actually a very challenging degree. And but I still had that sort of, the way I'd done it myself, I wanted it to be like a doula. So I now do home births and I get my women singing a lot. I use all the breath work and sound.
What do you do if they've got a bad voice?
I sing for them. Okay. I hum along. No, it doesn't matter if you're a good voice. I just get them humming. And then it's like an out-of-body experience. They all say I could hear the sort of the humming, the sounds, the frequency.
Well, it's vibration too.
It's the vibration without really being aware. It's helping with the breath as well.
Michelle and I have gone to sound healing recently, and it's an extraordinary experience.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Sound is, I think it's a very underutilized healing process.
Well, my mum, she can do sound healing as well with kinesiology. And I remember one particular session she was doing with me. I was lying on the bed and she had the tuning forks and was doing it over my body. And I was watching my, I don't know if it was intestines or what it was, rising as she's doing the forks over them and pulling them up. And she wasn't touching my skin at all, but my stomach, guts, whatever, we're coming
up. Or was it wind, possibly?
It could have been. But it was coming up and she was kind of playing
But
with
you
it.
Feel
and
it. When you play the heart frequency, you feel it in your heart. Mm. You absolutely do. And sound is, we all know that, you know, if your teenager is being a bit grumpy, you put the right music on and just, it can change their state immediately.
Yeah.
I think we've all been to Tony Robbins events and the way he uses music and then it anchors you as well.
Correct. Yeah.
So, opera still anchors me a lot. And it's very, very moving going to performances as well.
I can imagine. What did you learn being an opera singer? What lessons did you take away from it? Because we often talk about how everything that you do in life is just another tool that goes into your toolkit. So you learn lessons, you learn skills. What would you say were the big skills or lessons that you got out of your career?
Oh, so many. So many. As I was saying to you, the process of creation is in many ways more important than the end result.
Yeah.
That putting something together and the passion you can put into something and actually taking risks in that creative process. And if they don't work, it doesn't matter because it's a means to an end to get to the final goal. And living with passion, as I said to you before, the passion I felt on stage has not been, it wasn't great for my marriage because my marriage lacked that passion, but I still believe in it. I still believe in that absolute incredible connection that people can have, whether it's, Madame Butterfly has her sidekick Suzuki, which is a girlfriend, which is my Michelle.
Our captain.
But it's that the bonds you have and the camaraderie. There are so many parallels with life. And, you know, in terms of, you know, I think I was, my big thing, my mum always used to say to me, oh, life's not a dress rehearsal, you've got to get out there. But I think it's okay to think of parts of your life as a dress rehearsal and to say it's okay, this is happening because it's leading me towards my big performance.
Yeah.
And we all have those magic moments, those incredible moments that would not have happened unless you'd fallen down and taken different directions along the way. So if you are doing something and it's not working, that's okay, and you can find another way. And perhaps if you didn't make the mistakes the first time around, you're not going to find the new path to get you towards where you should be. And you know that happens all the time in singing, you know, and being able to just cope with those, you know, disappointments sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you think you've got something, you know, you work on something you think is amazing and you turn up and there might be somebody who has a completely different vision, and just trusting sometimes that things will unfold as they should, because they always do.
You sound like you've got the same motto that Michelle and I share. It's everything works out for us.
Mm. It does.
Everything works out for
us. Julia is the most optimistic and opportunistic.
It's in a combination of the two.
Your language is extraordinary.
I've only had two coffees, yes. And the person that I know, tell me, going back to the gay dining.
Yes.
You were saying this morning that, you know, you have these passionate, you know, moments on stage with that partner that you had in your role, and then the curtain comes down and they're gay and you go off and like it could never work because they have a partner.
Yes, exactly.
You fell in love on stage and then, you know, the curtain comes down. So was that because of those relationships potentially? Was that where the gay dining
absolutely. I was the biggest, I don't know if you can say fag hag, fruit fly, whatever you want to say these days. But all of my besties back then were men and gay men. And back then it was very different. The gay scene was very different. Mm. You went to clubs, you dressed up in your leathers. When I was at music college, we had a street called Canal Street, which is what the main gay area, and people always used to rub out the sea. I think they still do. but a lot of gay guys didn't want to be part of the whole queeny, crazy, and they were just like, I just want to meet somebody normally. Mm. So I literally put on a dinner party for my close gay friends, and there was sort of 20 people, and they was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And there was something coming up called the do you have the Ideal Home exhibition here? We have an Ideal Home exhibition, but it was a gay lifestyle, so they were calling it the Ideal Homo exhibition. So I put on one of my big operatic ball gowns. I had two poodles at the time who I dyed pink.
Right.
And I set up Out and Out, which was at the time we had 20 members who were my friends. I was marketing it as this amazing dining club where you could, you know, escape the scene and meet men like you. And it grew and grew and grew. And this was word of mouth. It was advertising in little columns in newspapers. And it was very much needed at the time. We changed lives. We had marriages. We had people who'd never told a soul they were gay, but felt it was a safe space. So that was a passion. That was a real passion of mine. And the internet came along and we were not so needed. And we could have developed more, but at that point I was doing other things. And, you know, the world, it's now obviously very normal and accepted, almost quite cool to be gay. So it was fine. So that's... It was the right place at the right time. And that's, you know, you've always got to move and be in the right place at the right time. Mm. We were sort of the blockbuster of our time. So we
see opportunity in things, or you create opportunity, which I love about you. So if we're on our chats that we have and different ideas, we're ideas people. And
yes,
we are between us, you know, brainstorm and think of, and some of the ideas and the opportunities are so fantastical that there's no way, but then there's an element that is doable and can be done, and it's like, oh, why can't it be done? Why can't the big thing be done? And
sure,
you've won awards for your screenplays. You've won. Is it screenplays?
That's right. So during COVID, when everything was shut down, there were a lot of out of work actors, sound technicians. So we had the sound technician from Star Wars working. So I wrote a little movie.
Which we'll put in the show notes because it's amazing. Yes.
Yeah. So it was basically comparing the conditions needed to make a baby to having a baby. And they're very similar. Feeling safe, having consent, feeling
private,
love, privacy, that oxytocin-rich environment. And it's something I'm passionate about and is why I work as a private midwife, because I struggled to enable women to create that atmosphere in a hospital atmosphere. But that's another story. So yes, I created this little film and I managed to get the most incredible cast, the most incredible technicians, because everybody was out of work and climbing the walls because of COVID. And so I managed to put this short movie together for probably about £1,500, which was very cheap at the time. And put it out there thinking it would be a really nice little learning tool. And it ended up going viral, hundreds of thousands of views. I think we won about 12 massive international awards. I got the screenwriter for the London Film Festival. I got the American Cinematography Award. There were many film festivals and we were shocked. I then had people all around the world saying, can I use this? We were used in Sydney, actually. We're in Their midwifery department have said, do you mind if we use the film? So it's really helping people, and that thrills me. So I'm now looking at making a feature film, and several feature films.
Yes.
Because one of our feature films, of course, is our story, Michelle.
Yes.
Which we've discussed many ways of doing it. I think that's definitely a film in the making.
Mm.
And but I've also would like to expand the short film I did. I can see that being a sort of type Netflix series. That sort of, yeah. But I mean, my kids often say to me, what, going back to what you were saying, sorry, ADHD brain. My kids will often say to me, you know, you come up with so many ideas and you don't do half of them. And I was like, yes, that's the point.
That's
but
right.
You do a lot of them.
I do it. Yeah. You only, the amount of ideas I have, I only need to do 2% of them. Mm. And I'm very busy.
Yeah.
And quite often going through with those ideas then opens up to other ideas that
exactly.
You hadn't thought of. So it's like, yeah, it's ever evolving idea session.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And you know, and then speaking to people and letting them bounce their ideas off me. Like before we started this, you just showed me this beautiful house that you're saying is out of your budget. And I swear to you, by the time I leave, you will be buying that house because we are going to find a way. There is always a way.
Yes.
I am here at the right time because you are going to buy that house.
That's right. We've got 4 days to come up with that.
Yes. Yes. We'll get there. We'll get there.
I used to see ideas as entities that flowed past everyone.
Yes.
And it took a special person like yourself and like Michelle to grab those ideas, put your nuance around it, and then the really, truly special people are those that then act on it.
Elizabeth yes. Gilbert has that in her book. She's got a book, Magic Happens, I think it's called, and that is her, what she says in it as well, that ideas are flowing.
Yeah.
And they're open for everyone. So if you have the idea, unless you act upon it, it will go to someone else.
Well, this is why you'll have a new invention and somebody in London is making this at the same
Correct.
Time as Sydney because
Correct.
It's just out there
yes.
at the
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
For sure. And that's what manifesting is, isn't it? It's opening your brain to that particular idea and grabbing it as it's coming past you.
And
for
seeing
sure.
the opportunity in everything. So some people might see a bunch of garbage and another person might see... I saw recently on social media there is a business in Melbourne and I can't think of what they're called, but they get all soft plastics that are in the rubbish, or not all, obviously, within their area, and they have a coffee shop, so they use all soft plastics that they use in their shop, and they melt them together with an iron and then use that as like a leather replacement and make bags and purses and things
Amazing.
Out of that.
Yes.
So it's utilizing, and they never have a shortage of material because they're just using soft plastics.
Something similar to what you did in uni. You told me that you didn't have a lot of money, you're doing art, and so everything
right.
you found on the street became an artwork.
And that's
right.
never stopped, really.
No,
that's
right. just look around.
Yes. Yeah. but there is, and like, you know, you've got to. You have to, where your energy goes, your focus goes, your energy will flow.
Absolutely.
And so if you do wake up having a bad day and you say, no, I'm an optimistic person. I believe that, you know, this bad day is going to lead to a good one. And, you know, nobody wants to go to a movie where it's like, it's beautiful at the beginning, it's beautiful in the middle, it's beautiful at the end. It's just boring.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so you have to have sometimes those uncomfortable moments to make you see opportunity and to make you see, you know, what the possibilities are. And, you know, so at the moment I feel, slightly, you know, we were saying about what do you do? And I, well, I'm not really singing. And, you know, the midwifery to me is a passion. That's not who I am or my job. But so I, at the moment, I feel actually a little bit excited. I don't know what it is, but I know there's something, there's another, you know, I've had the gay dining club, I've had the singing, I've had the midwifery. There's a
and
big,
property development, you, and you see gems in everything.
Yes, and the property development is, I've always felt that's, you know, it's fun finding the opportunities, and that's always been my bread and butter, and everything else is sprinkles and jam and sparkles. So but there's another sprinkles and jam and sparkles ahead, and I don't know what it is, but I'm open to it.
Well, mm. We'll do another podcast when it's happening.
Yeah, sure.
I want to talk to you about the concept of the muse. Artists talk about the muse. What are your thoughts around that topic? Does your muse visit you? Do you ride it in waves? Because one of the things Michelle and I have been talking about a lot lately is that we tend to find our creative, well, I tend to find my creativity or my passions, they come in waves. And it's about finding when you're at the top of the wave and riding the wave, but when it's at the bottom, not getting so frustrated that it's not there. That's the way I'm thinking about it at the moment. But
I think a lot of that is mindset, isn't it? Mm. You've got to be open to feeling that muse.
Yeah.
And it does, I mean, I do think in the arts, and I consider myself an artist, even though I've made my money probably from property, but arts is always, and to me, midwifery is artistry as well. But I think in the arts, it's a sort of a higher spiritual plane. And it is like you're channeling. Mm. You're channeling. When I was singing 100%, I felt that that voice was coming through me. Mm. And I had to technically, yes, be perfect to allow that voice to come through me in a way that wasn't going to be offensive. Mm. But it is a feeling that it's from a higher plane, for sure. And you have to be open to that. And it's the same with writing. I've been in Australia for several weeks, and before I came to Sydney, I had this beautiful apartment on a beach, and my intention was to come out and write. And I came out as, I'm going to write. And each morning I was waking up, I've got to write. And that was actually shutting me down. Mm. And in the end, I actually allowed the muse to take over. And it was, when I was least expecting it, I just thought, I'm just going to journal. I'm just going to free flow. And then I wrote down a lot of, I think, some really good stuff that I can keep working with. But I think it's letting go, as you say, of the ego. Mm. And that's, again, so as we were saying about, I mean, maybe it's different. Maybe there's more head than heart in being a pilot. Mm. But when you're singing, you definitely feel that muse is coming through you.
Yeah. There's kind of two theories to it. I was very fortunate to have dinner with an author, Bryce Courtney. He wrote The Power of One, Tandia, Tom Owen Hawke. He's one of Australia's most prolific authors. He was a South African gent that moved out to Australia. And I was sitting down with him at dinner because I was young and I wanted to be an author at some stage. And I said, so tell me about your writing process and tell me how much of what you write do you use? And he said, well, I just write every day. And I said, so does the muse come to you? No, I just sit down and write every day. And I said, well, how much of your writing do you use? And he said, oh, it's maybe only 10%. Now, that guy started writing after he retired from full-time work. He'd had a full career in advertising. And the books that he's written would take up more than an arm span on a bookshelf. So the amount of writing that came out of him later in his life is extraordinary. So that's one, I guess, approach to art and writing. Like, he just punched it out and then found the gold in the 10%. But like you're saying, some artists just learn how to let the muse visit.
I think when it becomes very technical, I think you can see that, and it becomes turgid, like in writing.
I'm doing writing a book at the moment, and I am editing and editing and editing. And I was speaking to a mentor who said, you know, you've got to stop. You have this either fear of success or fear of failure, which is stopping you from actually putting it forward.
Yes.
So it's that thing of, okay, what we were talking yesterday, what was it? It was motion over motivation. So
the motion before motivation.
Yes,
leading one to the other. Yes.
Yeah. So a lot of people think you've got to be motivated before you start, but quite often it's just starting and then the motivation
catches up. Well, I mean, you're an artist. I remember going to life drawing classes, and I was really terrible because I was really trying to measure everything. And then we were doing those 2-minute portraits,
yes,
or 30-second portraits, and I was really good. So because there's no time to let your brain interfere.
That's it.
And
yeah,
then my proportions, everything, and it was like, oh, these are really cool. But then we slowed down and did a 2-hour portrait. No good.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes you just have to let it flow.
Get out of your own way.
Yeah, for sure.
I've loved hearing your story. I think we could do 4 or 5 of these and go more into depth. You're an extraordinary woman, Julia. I've heard a lot about you, so it's so lovely to meet you in person.
I'm blushing.
And like the amazing Captain Michelle, you are a polymath, and I look forward to hearing all of the wonderful things that you end up doing and producing in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on and sharing
some
of your
journey. Thank you. I think you're wonderful.
No, you are.
I love you more.
I love you the most.
All right, so I'll sign off all these two. Continue looking lovingly into their eyes. Bollinger, where are you?
Yeah.
Bose, yeah. Come on. And Lint, seriously. Yeah. At least we've got the car wash kid.
Yes.
Thank you again, Julia.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun.
That was fun.
You're such a clown.
The clown.
Lady Captain. Lady. There we go.
And who's going to listen to this? Maybe our mums.
Thanks, Mum.